Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Wednesday Conversation. It's a special episode because it's just me today, Bob Thune from Cormdale Church, and I'm here with my special guest and friend, Trevin Wax. Trevin, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on. Long time listener.
That's good to know. Thank you for being a listener from afar. We're without Dusty and Chris and Bethany today, and so I'm going to just sit down and have a conversation with Trevin. And actually, what I want to talk about is a topic that we had talked about just recently here on the podcast. So we did an episode, Trevin, with a listener who wanted to, who was asking about catechism. Hey, what does the word catechism mean? Why do we use that word? This is someone who's coming from a tradition where that's not as familiar. And so we did a broader podcast on the topic of catechisms and creeds and confessions and why we use them. But I thought, well, one of the things we mentioned on that podcast was your new project that you have just released called The Gospel Way Catechism. And so I wanted to actually get you to drill a little deeper on that subject and on just sort of what your, why you're thinking about this and why you've been working on it over the past year or two. And I think where I wanted to start is just to ask you to talk a little bit about you in that catechism, in the introduction, you talk about the idea of counter catechesis, which just a longer, it's an even longer word that I think can feel intimidating to people. But what is that? What do we mean by that?
Yeah. So just, The funny thing about catechism is because it is it's a big word, it can be a scary word. There are people that may have had bad experiences in the past where they had to, you know, it was all about sort of just rote memorization only. And it was just like, you got to make sure you get this right to pass the test kind of a thing. But rightly understood and historically understood, a catechism just means instruction. And it's an ancient tool of discipleship that it shouldn't be scary. It should be simple. Hmm. The word may sound, you know, like it's intimidating, like it's for super Christians, but it really, it's all it is it's basic Christianity in a question and answer format that's meant to be committed to memory so that you understand the basics of the Christian faith. Back in the ancient church days, the early church days after the New Testament and then the first centuries of the church, a lot of times before people would, when they were preparing for baptism, they called them catechumens. They were going through the instruction. Now, whether all of that was exactly question and answer the way that we have centuries later is you know, part of discussion. But you can even go back to like the Didache and stuff. Like you can see some of these teaching elements that are already there. Some of these early, you know, documents that we have of the early church. There's really an explosion of catechisms at the Reformation time. That's where you really see this sort of question and answer format come into its own. And you usually have, you may have heard of like, there's the Westminster larger catechism, then there's the Westminster shorter catechism, there's Luther's small catechism, right? These are all like these different kinds of questions and answers going through the basics of the Christian faith, generally, you know, major doctrines, walking through like, what does the Apostles' Creed mean? You know, what are the Ten Commandments? What do we mean by the Ten Commandments? It's all that, but it's, you've got larger and smaller or shorter or whatever, basically based on, you know, are these for kids? Are these for brand new believers? Are these for, you know, believers that have been walking with the Lord for a while? And most of those Reformation catechisms are meant, here's where the counterpart comes in. Most of the Reformation catechisms were meant to explain the basics of Protestant Christianity as opposed to the dominant Roman Catholic, medieval Roman Catholic church of the time. So there's a sense in which all catechesis, all catechism is counter in that it's pushing against. This is something that Tim Keller was talking about a lot in the last years of his life was a catechism. And what we need today is not just, hey, what are the basics of Christianity, but what are the basic truths of Christianity as opposed to whatever is most dominant in the culture. Yeah, what are the cultural narratives? Things like
that's
that.
That's really interesting because as you mentioned that, I'm thinking about, yeah, all the Reformation catechisms usually have a section where they're explicitly countering some of the Roman Catholic, the medieval Roman Catholic doctrines, for instance, on the Lord's Supper or on baptism and so forth. So in what you've tried to do recently, how does a modern counter catechesis need to take sort of a different tack than that?
Well, it comes in both the questions and the answers. So when it comes to the answers, like what one of the questions we're asking is, you know, because the basic cultural narrative that people are operating by, worldview, social imaginary, whatever word you want to use for the outlook that people have on the world, sort of that passes for common sense that people just take for granted, generally speaking, not Roman Catholicism, certainly not medieval Roman Catholicism today. For the most part, it's expressive individualism, which you've talked about before on this program. So, you know, you be you, be true to yourself, all of that. It's, secular ideas of, or just secularism in the world, naturalism, that this world is all there is, you know. It's freedom, that it's really a freedom from constraint. Freedom really means not being bound by the past, by my family, by religion, by anything like that. It's a freedom from that loses its, what we would say, its teleology. That's its purpose. It's like, what are you free for? What is a human being? What is like, what are humans made for? You know, there's all sorts of other narratives that we could look at, but those are some of the dominant ones in our society today. So the question that my co-writer and I had when we first thought it would be great for us to try to figure out what would be 50 questions and answers that would provide the basics of Christianity, but it, as a way of countering some of those things that are most prevalent in our society today, that it came out in the answers a lot of times, but it also comes out in the questions. Like, we have a question, what is freedom? We have a question on suffering. We have a question on what is sexuality? We have questions. There's a whole section on creation and identity that's super important because so many of the issues today are around identity, right? But even then, like in some of the more traditional answers, like when we talk about baptism, the commentary actually connects the answer on baptism to identity politics today. He's like, what's the connection there? Well, it's because, rightly understood, baptism is the fundamental identity of the Christian, right? It marks you out as belonging to this family. So there's one group identity, you would say, that then, supersedes any other group that you may be a part of, or that people may want to categorize you in because of your, you know, some sort of immutable characteristic. So anyway, all that to say is by asking the question, what are the basics of Christianity and how would they provide a counterpoint to some of the dominant worldviews of the West, the 21st century North America, it was really an opportunity for a lot of creative ways, fresh ways at looking at, you know, time-tested biblical doctrine.
Tell us a little bit about the process of how did you decide on what 50 topics or questions, and how did you start thinking about, okay, what are the major narratives and how do they map on to these sort of doctrinal or classical Christian questions?
Yeah. So my friend Thomas West and I were the ones who worked on this, and we had talked about this for a couple of years before we did it. Both of us, he remembers where he was in the tube in London. He was planting a church in London when he first started thinking about this. And I remember where I was in Kentucky when Tim Keller talked about countercatechesis for the first time that I had heard. And, you know, we both remember the moment sort of where we were gripped by the need for this as a discipleship tool. And we talked about it for more than a year before we actually, you know, put our heads down. And it's kind of a fun origin story. I was a temporary scholar in residence at the Kilns, which is that house that C.S. Lewis lived in for, you know, more than 30 years. Thomas was church planting in London at the time, and he came down the train, and we spent basically a whole day in the common room of the Kilns, that one of the famous places where C.S. Lewis wrote a lot of his important works. And we're just basically pacing, walking, typing, praying, just what are the questions and answers that need to be here? And what are the dominant, you know, narratives that we need to address? And there were several of the big ones I mentioned, you know, secularism, obviously, a man-centered view of the world rather than a God-centered view of the world, expressive individualism, that be true to yourself, that the purpose of life is to look inside and to discover who you are and then express that to the world. The notions of freedom that I mentioned, identity politics, even transhumanism is one that when we got into some of the latter parts of the catechism about future hope and what Christian hope looks like, we are able to provide the contrast with some of the proposals that are out there that are, it's not science fiction anymore. It's really something to consider. Obviously these questions around sexuality and what it means to be made male and female, what it means to be embodied creatures. This is all really important. Because you're constrained by the Bible, there are certain questions that, even if the world isn't necessarily pushing back specifically on one question, there are certain questions and answers that you have to present just because you're, the Bible is setting your agenda, right? Like you, and we try to get like the storyline of scripture in there, the Trinity and whatnot. But even in, with the Trinity, like if we're asking the question, who is the Son of God? Well, when we talk about Jesus, we make sure we provide it's not this, but that kind of answer. You know, people in the world will think of Jesus as a good teacher, a good moral leader, a therapist who affirms all your desires, a life coach. You know, we basically say Jesus is not these things. He is. And then we provide the answer. So even when you're addressing some of like the key crucial doctrines that you're led to by scripture, you're always asking the question. And we were always asking the question, where is, you know, what's the world saying about this? So if we're defining prayer, well, we're recognizing that the world may see prayer in sort of the category of meditation, self-help, self-betterment. You know, it's about me and my personal spirituality kind of a thing. Well, we have to distinguish between that and what actual prayer is according to scripture. So even in those traditional questions, we're always asking the question, where, how does this make us stand out? You know,
did you start more in your process? Did you start more with, all right, here's some dominant narratives that we want to sort of fit in here? Or did you start with, here's the 50 things we want to cover, and then how do they map onto it? Sort of, which sides did you work from, or was it both and?
It was both and. That was the thing. So we already had an idea of the narratives, in part because Tim Keller had laid out a bunch of them. And also both Thomas and I are influenced by the missionary theologian Leslie Newbegin.
Yeah.
Thomas actually did his dissertation on Newbegin's view of scripture, critiquing and engaging with that. And so we already had, hey, here are the narratives that you've got to be engaged. We come to it with that question first. 21st century, if you're going to have a missionary encounter in the 21st century North American context, British context, Australia, you know, anywhere you are in sort of the Western world, what are the things you're going to have to look at? You're going to have to look at freedom, autonomy, expressive individualism, secularism, materialism, naturalism, you know, transhumanism, sexuality. Like you already kind of know these are the touch points. And a lot of those things are actually under the surface of many of the biggest debates we have in society and in the church. So we came with here are these narratives that are going to be addressed all throughout. Now we need to ask, what are the basics of Christianity? What are the things we just have to cover? Like if we don't have this in a catechism, people are going to be like, that's not robust enough. So then it was a question of what are the major doctrines that we need to make sure that we're in here. And we worked up the list of 50 or so, and in each one, we're going ahead and just sort of fleshing out this doctrine. The world says this, but the Bible says this, you know, the world's going to say this, but here's what Jesus says, you know? And so we basically had the outline in after a really long day of work. And then we refined that over a year, and we worked on one answer, question and answer, and some commentary and some scriptures, every week for a year that we tested in the local church in Thomas's church plant, that we were going back. We were on different continents at that point, but we'd go back and forth all week long, honing that, refining that, sending that out to an email list of some pastors, trusted friends. And then once we moved beyond that is when we sent it, once we had like all of it, at least in draft form, that's when we sent it out to, I know a lot of Keller Center fellow friends of mine. You were a big help on this. Yeah. The suggestions were great that we got everyone from like Kevin Van Hooser chipped in to like Michael Card, the singer-songwriter, for styling purposes. And I mean, it was just great to get a variety of people with different gifts looking at this. My favorite comment is Andrew Wilson, mutual friend of ours, who said his response after he read it and enjoyed it, said, well, it's not Heidelberg, which, you know, Heidelberg Catechism is like,
you mean that as a compliment or as a knock?
No, he just was like, well, you know, it was hilarious because I was like, you think? Yeah. Like Heidelberg Catechism, for listeners that aren't familiar with it, is one of the greatest, most pastorally assuring, just brilliantly written catechisms out there. And it's like, I had to tell Andrew, I was like, we're not trying to compete with like the classics, you know, like this is a much more modest supplement to the classics that we're trying to pull off, but it was fun.
I know you have your own children who, as you're writing the questions and answers, who do you have in mind? Do you have your own kids in mind? Are you thinking of kids in your church? Are you thinking of adults? Like, who's sort of your ideal reader as you and Thomas are framing the questions and trying to think about who's using this?
Yeah. So immediate context is new believers, and then students and adults who need to go deeper in their discipleship. So some adults may have been walking with Jesus for a long time, and we're already hearing from them. They're like, this is helping them realize that it's like eyes opening, like, oh, I've been more influenced by some of these some of what the world says than I realize. Like, I was buying into some of these things that just the contrast is really helpful even for long-term Christians. But we're thinking new disciples, new believers, students that are at whatever age are kind of new to the faith. We have a kids version coming out next year.
Okay.
That is currently in the illustration phase. It's simplified, so it's shorter, but it tracks all 50 questions track to the other 50 questions. So if parents are going through the adult resource, the kids by next year, they really would be able to have their own sort of, devotional time with it. And then the kids have, at a simplified level, the same doctrines covered.
Which is similar to how, I know that New City Catechism did something similar, yeah, where they sort of condense it down in a smaller, more memorable way, right, just for younger kids.
Yeah, it's kind of like larger and shorter. Now, when I say younger kids, though, we're thinking like 8 to 12.
Okay.
We don't have anything for, if you're 4 years old,
yeah,
you can go ahead and start memorizing it. But I think it's going to be just one, it's going to be a step above the five-year-old. It's going to be more like, seven, eight, nine.
Yeah. Talk about, as you've put it out there, how long has it been out now?
It came out in late July. Okay. So
a few months.
3 months. Yeah.
What's the uptake been like? What are you hearing? What's the good and bad of sort of how people are finding it?
Yeah, we met our pre-order goal, which was surprising to me, because I've never really, we had this goal of, hey, can we get a lot of churches, to jump onto this? And we blew past that, which was really exciting. So, but we started hearing from pastors right away who, once they got it, were saying they wanted to incorporate it either in a question and answer format in their church services.
Yeah.
Some pastors wanting to preach through it, which was great to hear. The Salt Company has been really,
yeah,
influential. Mark Vance, yep, at Cornerstone just was like, man, this is an answer to prayer. Like, he goes, you guys have been working on this. We've been praying for a resource like this for college students. Cause they're just seeing so many people come to faith, either from Salt Network, that they're coming from either church backgrounds, but not always discipled well, or, completely secular, non-church backgrounds as well. So they've seen it. The Summit Collaborative church planting movement that comes out of the Summit Church, out of J.D. Greer's church, has been really thrilled with what they've seen on it. So it's been fun to watch. It's really early, and the kids version isn't out yet too. So I'm curious to see what happens when both tools are out there and able to be used. We have also heard from some families that are like, hey, we're doing one of these a week, and we're going through these every day with our kids, and their kids are a little older, and are finding it to be a helpful resource. And I love hearing those stories. So,
well, thanks for putting a great tool out there. You and Thomas both. I love the fact that you went after writing a catechism. Cause like you said, it's not an easy thing to do. And
no.
if the bar is Heidelberg and Westminster, those are, it's a high bar to reach, right? It's hard to say, oh, we're going to try to bite off, something like that. So thanks for doing the work on it, but also just the ways that you, spent some time refining it and field testing it and just sort of putting it out there, because the challenging thing with a catechism is it's so different from a book. A book, it's like, well, here's my thoughts and I just want to put them out to the world. A catechism is it's designed to be so end user focused,
right,
that it really has to sort of work well, right. And so I appreciate that you guys went to the work to figure out, all right, do these questions work and do these answers work, and how do they settle with people, and are they too dense? Are they not styled well enough? All right. Those questions.
Well, if you're committing it to memory, the styling really matters more than you realize. And that's the beautiful thing about the classic catechisms is some of them are older English now. So right. It's, or the translations are older if they're, being translated from German or French or something like that. So, but that is one of the things that that makes it compelling is that it's got to be something short enough, but long enough, but memorable enough that you can commit it to memory. We really had fun with the commentaries, though. Their commentaries are like maybe 400 or 500 words. They're pretty short, but that's where there's a lot of times in like putting these questions and answers together, you want to say so much more, you know, on some of these answers. It's like, oh man, like we're going to cram everything we can into this sort of really potent bite-sized answer. But then we just have to, you know, remind ourselves, okay, we can't say everything, but we can get to the essence of the truth of this doctrine. And then we can unpack it in the commentary and really like just walk through it and help people see it's almost like a flower that you know, is blossoming there, or, you know, a seed that kind of can sprout and grow. So yeah, it's that's been fun too, is to watch how that commentary can help, you know, with as little Christianese as possible. Like we went through and did our very best to not assume Bible knowledge on the people, on the part of people. In part, it's because, I mean, Thomas's work in London was a lot of times with, you know, people who were very new to the Christian faith. So you got to start way back and you can't assume Bible knowledge, and you've got to just walk through the basics in this way. So we hope it's a great crash course for people that want to, you know, to know the basics of the Christian faith in a way that helps them shine like stars in a crooked and perverse generation, like Philippians says.
Well, thanks for doing the work on it and putting it out there. And I hope listeners will use this as an opportunity to go take a look at it, the Gospel Way Catechism, and put it to work. I guess we're just going to turn this podcast into the Trevin Wax book release podcast, because I just realized I also want to ask you about the project we worked on together called The Gospel After Christendom, which is just rolling out. As of this podcast coming out, it will be out for a few weeks here. And I wanted to hear, so that's a different kind of project, something quite different from the catechism project, but kind of in the same vein, in the sense that we're trying to help people understand what does it mean to sort of speak to cultural narratives. So Talk a little bit about the chapter you wrote for that project, which is a collaborative project.
Yeah, no, it was fun to be able to be part of that with some of our friends in the Keller Center. The Gospel After Christendom is basically making the case that, you know, the circumstances of our of Western society, of American society, are different now in terms of the background knowledge, the assumptions, the presuppositions, the what people take for granted to be common sense in the world. And if we're going to make a case for the gospel, going to defend the truths of the gospel, we've got to be conscious of the changing circumstances. And there's some old methods and tools. The book calls it cultural apologetics. There's a little bit of disagreement among the Keller Center fellows, even in the book, as to how helpful that is as a term, because it really goes back to, you know, Augustine and others have done this. But the idea is, that you're not only making a case for the truth of Christianity, but you're simultaneously being careful to give attention to the goodness and beauty of Christianity in such a way that you're in the work that you're doing. And that my chapter is called, is one of the early ones where I basically say, this is another tool for evangelism. It's a way of understanding the plausibility structures of change in society. And in order for us to be able to make a good case for Christianity, we have to be attuned to those things, to what has changed in the culture. And the emphasis on the beauty of Christianity, the emphasis on the church as embodying Christianity, the connection points that we have in our culture, where we're seeking to show that some of these cultural narratives that people believe are going to bring fulfillment and happiness actually let them down, as all idolatrous views eventually do. But that there is this way of, you know, Dan Strange calls it subversive fulfillment. So the gospel confronts and counters the lies that our culture believes, but in a way that fulfills the deeper longings that would lead people to adopt that cultural narrative in the first place, or would lead people down the road where they might fall for for a lie. So the gospel comes along and there is that edge of confrontation, but there's also that fulfilling of the deeper God-given longing that may be leading someone in a according to their misdirected desires, you know, which is how is a really Augustinian way of thinking about sin. So yeah, I get to kind of introduce the idea of cultural apologetics as one of the tools in the tool belt that we should pull out, we should use. And are you going to talk about yours?
I will eventually if you want me to, but I would love to, first of all, so talk to us, because this is a question I get a lot, is what is cultural apologetics? What do you guys mean by that? And you said, okay, it can be a fuzzy term for people. It's helpful when you say it's just kind of what Augustine was doing. It's kind of what people know Tim Keller was doing if they're familiar with his work. What's your sort of simplest way of describing what we're talking about there?
Yeah, I mean, the reason that, you know, even we have disagreement about the helpfulness of the term is because there's no, all apologetics are cultural at some level, yeah, right? Like there's no such thing as non-cultural apologetics, because we're all enculturated people and we're presenting the gospel or making a case for Christianity in a culture, in a time, in a place, in a certain way. But I think the reason why the term has been sticky, so to speak, is that it's recognizing, again, it's recognizing a little bit more of a holistic view, that you're not just talking to the intellect to make an intellectual case for Christianity. Yeah. That's part of it.
That's good.
But it's not all of it.
Yeah.
The beauty and goodness components are important there. Again, it's not brand new, because even Pascal, you know, was saying one of the, you know, that you want to present Christianity in such a way that an unbeliever would want it to be true, even if they don't believe it's true. And then after you get there, once the heart has flipped to where they see Christianity as attractive in that way, then you provide the defense to show that it is true, you know? So you can see it in Pascal, you can see it in Augustine. You've got this historical precedent for it. But back to like the definition, I mean, cultural apologetics is really seeking to line up Christianity in a way that re-narrates the story of the world for people. That's what Augustine does in the City of God. That's what we're trying to do. So we take the cultural narratives that are coming against Christianity, or that are opposed in some way to Christianity, and you show where those distinctions are, where it's in line with, then where it falls short of true Christianity, and how the gospel is the solution. So it's not so much a method; it's more of an instinct.
Yeah.
In the way that you're trying to plow the ground to do evangelism. I call it pre-evangelism rather than actual evangelism.
It's a good way of talking. There's a part in the City of God where Augustine does this really brilliantly, and I know that work is so large, and it's sort of a class. It's Augustine's most classic work, but he goes into this little, he's arguing with the Romans about how, you know, their claim was Christianity's fault that the Roman Empire has fallen. And he goes into this whole thing about how a Roman would pray about the threshold of their house. And there's one God for the threshold. There's one God for the door. There's a God for the hinge at the door. And so his whole point is like, well, what if you remember to pray for the God of the threshold and the God of the door, but you forget to pray to the God of the hinge? Does that mean you haven't done your job? And his whole point is sort of saying, he's sort of poking at the inconsistencies of the way the Romans actually lived versus what they believed the universe to be about. And it's sort of, I sort of see him doing that same thing. It's a creative way. It's truth focused. He's trying to tell them, hey, your worldview doesn't make sense on its own merits, but he's doing it in a clever and creative way. That's sort of, it's narrative. It's inviting a conversation. It's deconstructive in a helpful way.
Right. And he doesn't shy away from showing, I mean, there are times when Augustine can get really pointed,
yeah,
you know, in the City of God, where he's really, you know, not just poking a hole, but sometimes like, just like wanting to like demolish the wall that somebody's, but he's doing it with an eye to rebuilding. The thing that is a challenge for any apologist or any evangelist, I think today, is that a lot of people live with incoherence,
yeah,
in their, at the worldview level,
yeah,
and are just fine with it.
True.
Like, I mean, just, it's incoherent. It doesn't fit, doesn't work. It doesn't even make sense. It's logically inconsistent. And as we've seen with a lot of debates in society, I mean, some of the ideologies that have been very prevalent in the last 10 years are logically inconsistent and incoherent. And yet people are still trying to measure their, you know, to make sense of their life through that lens.
Yeah. I'll talk about my chapter because it will lead me into a question I want to ask you. So my chapter in this book is on the church as an apologetic. And basically the whole chapter is an extended commentary on a quote from Leslie Newbegin. There's a famous quote in the Gospel and Pluralist Society where he talks about the church being the only hermeneutic of the gospel. And what he says is people can read the Bible, but it's only when they see it lived out in the community of the church that it becomes plausible in a fuller way to them. And so I was just, I quoted that quote from New Begin, and then I just sort of unfolded, how does this work itself out in the life of the church? So if the church wants to be a community that effectively shows a healthy picture of the gospel, what kind of church does it need to be, and how does the church do that? And so I sort of talk a little bit about what the church needs to look like. It's kind of stuff that we would put in the category probably of gospel culture. How does a church need to be a healthy gospel sort of community? And then I talk about what the church does when it preaches and when it worships and when it serves the city and when it gathers in community, and just says all of these things are themselves an apologetic. They have apologetic value. And the reason I think that chapter is needed is because I grew up in a tradition I know many people in America are used to thinking of, oh, evangelism and apologetics is only something you do when you're trying to explicitly communicate the gospel to someone. Mm. Or yeah, you do it as an individual with your neighbor. They're not thinking about how the entire gathering of God's people is itself saying something. And so I wanted to try to bring that forward a little bit, hopefully in a way that people find helpful, and especially for pastors or church planters or people who are trying to build or maintain a healthy church. What should we be thinking about together? So I'm sort of obviously standing on New Begin's shoulders there, which made me want to ask you, you're such an articulate, you're really good at taking things and condensing them and summarizing them. So I wanted to say, how would you give us like, what's a dummy's guide to Leslie New Begin? I mean, he is an important figure in missiology. And I know you leaned on him for some of your intro to your catechesis book. We leaned on him a lot for the cultural apologetic stuff. If someone is unfamiliar and hasn't read Leslie New Begin, how would you describe what he did or what he gave us that was significant for just understanding where we are in the world?
Yeah, you know, so Leslie New Begin, a little bit about his story is important for that, because I really don't think you can understand him or his legacy apart from the story. The guy was a missionary from England. He went to India and was basically there for the better part of, you know, I don't remember if it was 3 or 4 decades. I mean, he was in India as a missionary for a long time. When he comes back to the UK, he realizes the mission field is home as well. Like, and is recognizing what Western culture needs to have an encounter, a missionary encounter with the gospel itself. It's not just sort of, this is the sending culture. This is a culture in need of gospel renewal and this missionary encounter to take place. And he's really, really clear about that. And he continued, and he just basically, what's fascinating about New Begin is the most significant things that he's known for are things he wrote in the latter years of his life as a retired, somewhat, you know, quote unquote, retired missionary who's back in the UK. And he's writing about these things. So he's got, you know, he's got famous books. Some of them are shorter and easier to jump into. If there's one that you have to read, like one book that sort of is the best one-stop shop place to go for Leslie New Begin, I think it would be the one you mentioned, The Gospel in a Pluralist Society. That's going to be tough sledding for people that don't sort of read in the theology space.
Read.
Yeah. It's going to take some time. So there's an easier one. Foolishness to the Greeks is one that's quite a bit shorter. Mm. Not quite as difficult. But there's also someone who I find to be a really helpful explainer and somewhat popularizer of Leslie New Begin, and that is Michael Goheen. Hmm. Mike Goheen has a couple of books that are focusing on Leslie New Begin and his vision of the church and of mission. And I think there's one called The Church and Its Vocation. I think it may be the name of it. But it's basically Goheen explaining and quoting a lot from New Begin. So you kind of have him as a guide. And I think he's just phenomenal at really breaking it down. Still going to be a little more on the, hey, you got to really put your thinking cap on as you sit down and read this. But, you know, if you read, you know, a chapter a week of Goheen on New Begin, you get a pretty good crash course in New Begin's overall thought.
That's helpful. I've never read Goheen, so that's actually a helpful cue for listeners to know that. Well, Trevin, thanks for being a guest on the podcast. Thanks for taking some time just to sit down and talk about the stuff you've worked on and some of the things you are currently working on. It's really a blessing to connect with you, and I hope listeners will go read your stuff and be helped by it. So thanks for taking the time to talk it through with me.
Man, thanks for having me on. Honored to be here.
The goal of this podcast, as we always say, is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or a church leader in another context, like Trevin is, thanks for listening in. We pray that this conversation might be helpful to you as you minister in your own context. We always love to hear what topics you would like us to talk about or questions that you want us to address. So if you have feedback or topic ideas, reach out, podcast@cdomaha.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next week for another episode of the Wednesday Conversation.